listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Matt Shelton, great to have you with us again here on RCR. We're talking about New Zealand doctors speaking out with Science, NZD, SOS, and their submission to the Royal Commission of Inquiry into COVID-19. Firstly, I'm intrigued, how come an organisation like yours, which many will say is anti-vax, anti-establishment, how come you got to appear in front of this very establishment body?
Well, hi, Peter. Look, I've just got to say, I always enjoy speaking to you because you and I kind of got our break together, I guess. You were the first person to talk to somebody on the other side of the fence, as it were. And you know, look, 3 years later, where we are, both of us, for better or worse. So thank you very much for having me on. Look, that's an interesting question. We were actually invited earlier on in the piece, last November, actually, and we declined because we knew that the terms of reference were going to be restrictive, and our chief interest, of course, was in vaccine harms and the fact that it didn't seem to be working. And we weren't allowed to talk to that. So we sort of politely declined, and really we didn't want to sort of dignify their process since they were so obviously excluding a topic that's really very important to many New Zealanders. And the heart of the whole thing, I mean, the mandates followed from the assumption that this thing would stop transmission. And in fact, even if it had been proven to stop transmission, there was still a very strong human rights case that, you know, mandates were not justified and shouldn't have been imposed on people. So we heard from Voices for Freedom that the commissioners commented that they hadn't heard the doctors were being censored and sort of discriminated and punished for saying what we were saying. So we thought, well, let's actually then, if there is an opportunity to be heard on the effect of the mandates on us and on medicine, let's grab this opportunity, knowing, of course, that phase two is coming up and that there's supposedly an opportunity to talk about things that are much more, just as important to us in the second phase. So we toddled along on Tuesday, three of us, last week in Wellington, and spoke to the commissioners face to face.
And how much time did you get? Like, was it a select committee where you had maybe 5 or 10 minutes, as you normally do in a parliamentary inquiry, or did you have a much longer time?
Oh, no, we actually had 90 minutes, and we used every single minute. It seems like they're sort of winding up, I think, and they're probably even starting on the report, I guess. So we, we were pleased to be able to present face-to-face because it's always good to meet people in person.
And what was the main thrust of what you said there, Matt?
Okay, well, so three of us presented. We each did our own thing and sort of slightly different flavour because we wanted to keep them awake, I guess. But we really wanted to leave them with an understanding of the effect that particularly the mandate from the Medical Council. They produced this guidance document that you may know we're actually challenging in court next month, which said two things, that doctors were to be vaccinated and that we were supposed to limit our discussion about the vaccine to the positives only. Now, this has had a devastating effect on the whole of the profession, but it also acted as the first sort of de facto mandate in a profession. So this was sort of March, April 2021. And at that stage, the government was talking about the border workers needing to be redeployed to different areas if any of them refused vaccination. So there wasn't at that stage a kind of rock hard mandate for the border workers. But subsequently, it sort of became one. And the many of them were, moved out and lost their jobs. If they refused to be vaccinated. So we were, hit with this guidance document that we've said all along, was above the law, didn't have a legal status.
And this was a paper issued by the Medical Council, MCNZ, Medical Council of New Zealand, said this to the doctors, the organisation that regulates the medical profession in New Zealand. It was essentially an instruction, huh?
It was, and it was a joint statement with the Dental Council and the other regulatory authorities like nursing and osteopaths, chiropractors, etc., all got in behind and sort of enjoined with it. But it was the medical council and dental council that between them, produced this statement, and in conjunction with some public statements shortly afterwards by the chairman of our medical council, it became clear that they considered that any anti-vaccine misinformation, that was anything that might encourage vaccine hesitancy. So somebody might choose not to be vaccinated, which is enshrined in the Bill of Rights and the HTC Act. You know, there are all sorts of protections. There's New Zealand case law that says actually people can decline, whatever medical treatment they want, actually. So this was another norm that was pushed aside. And we, our position is that the rollout, may not have happened so easily without this sort of initial preemptive strike, if you like.
Okay, so you're having this tested in
ethical
court.
Medicine.
Yeah, you're having this tested in court in a short time. What was the attitude, particularly of Tony Blakely as the doctor, as the epidemiologist on the commission? What was the attitude as you were submitting on these lines? Was there almost a sneering attitude, or was he accepting your submission in good faith, bearing in mind that I guess in the medical hierarchy, he regards himself as an epidemiologist, a specialist, superior to a mere old GP like yourself?
Well, actually, not at all, Peter. No, they both listened hard. They did ask some good questions, and they were respectful. It wasn't a difficult or a tense meeting, actually. And they've been at this a long time, and they've listened to lots and lots of people. So, they knew how to conduct it. We were politely reminded on a couple of occasions that we have RCI phase two in which to, litigate questions of safety and effectiveness. We couldn't help but refer to deaths and injuries in several places. But we knew that this is unlikely to make it into the report. Because remember, this is all in private, and the commissioners have discretion over what goes into the report in the end.
You put a bizarre.
We got a good hearing, and we felt we covered the sort of the curriculum of things that we've all been concerned about, and that you've heard a lot about on RCR, of course, in the last few years.
Yeah. You find it bizarre, Matt, that these hearings are being conducted in private, and that if you're not talking to me, then what you have said, what you have submitted, is never going to be made public. Do you find it strange that what other people have submitted to the Royal Commission of Inquiry Phase 1 is never going to be made public either, and that what the final report says may or may not reflect what they've heard for the last however long it's been?
Well, we're certainly making public what we said, and we clarified right at the beginning that actually the presentations that we brought could be put up for the public, and we're doing just that. We've got a web page that we're just putting up on our website, which will have those. In fact, it might even be available already. We didn't quite get everything finished, so we said to them, "Look, we've got another 8 testimonials, video testimonials from some of our doctors, just a couple of minutes each, who describing the effects on them personally of everything that's happened, and particularly losing their jobs, or having controls on the way they practice, or in fact having been driven out of medicine altogether." So we didn't have time to get through all those. So we've left them with a webpage where they said they would look at all those, but that will be public facing any second, including the presentations that Cindy Allison and I gave orally. We worked from notes, but the discussion free ranged a little bit with questions. And there was an interesting moment at the beginning where we were asked to consider that we were under an NDA, non-disclosure agreement. So we all thought, oh, gold, here we go. But actually it was just really about anything that the commissioners might say in response to some of the things that we'd said, or things that would, might come up and sort of go off reservation. But there actually wasn't much of that. And so we're comfortable with putting up the presentations that we took.
So did you agree to the NDA?
Well, when it was explained that it wouldn't cover, it wouldn't suppress what we'd come to say, yes, and we have to, respect that it is a process, and there are, rules around a royal commission as opposed to a sort of public inquiry. And so, yes, it is in private, and that rankles, of course, as will the next one. But you know, that there are other issues with the next one too that we're a little concerned about that perhaps we can talk about later.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, our you know, we were heard and they were respectful, and you know, we're very grateful that we had that opportunity, and it's actually thanks to Katie and Alia that we did.
Do you expect any of the content of your submission to actually make it into the final report from phase one from Blakely and John Whitehead?
Well, I'm positive. I expect that some of it will. You know, it may not. But, you know, we know what we said, and the public will know what the commission was told as well. You know, they'll be able to read it. We hope for the best. And, you know, look, Tony pushed back, Tony Blakely, on a couple of things that we said, you know, from his perspective as a public health specialist, and that was fine. You know, we actually had a sort of professional level conversation on a couple of points, but overall, they, you know, they listened and they listened well, and we weren't sort of shut down in any way, really, yeah, well, other than just being reminded that we had phase two, to look forward to.
That's good. So let's talk about phase two, which is underway in November. The commissioners have been appointed: Grant Ellingworth, KC, Anthony Hill, former Director General of Health, Deputy Director General of Health, also a barrister, and the third member, whose name escapes me currently, is an economist. First up...
Judy Kavanagh, correct.
Thank you for that, for filling in the gap. Are you worried that in phase two there is nobody with any medical or scientific background on the commission?
Oh, look, worried. Look, it's disappointing, isn't it? You know, the whole point of phase two has to been to look at scientific issues. And our experience of the courts, certainly so far, has been that they're very reluctant to engage with the science, and have this automatic sort of default to, you know, government science, even if the government doesn't turn up with any. You know, we've had very powerful affidavits and presentations from, you know, world-renowned experts in the various cases that we followed and that we've been involved with. And they might as well have not bothered, it seems to us, when you read the, you know, some of the dismissive comments by judges. But having said that, you know, both of these two, Anthony Hill and Ellingworth, you know, they're both barristers. And in fact, Grant Ellingworth, I think, is a criminal barrister. So, you know, there'll be some things that will have to get their attention, I think, based on their training and their experience. So, you know, we'll just do our best with what we've been given, and assume the best of them, and you know, plan for the worst, of course. You know, we are disappointed that there's no medical expertise.
Yeah, but I looked at the scope of the terms of reference, the clauses under scope of the inquiry last week, Matt. Yes, you can talk about vaccine safety, vaccine efficacy, but there's two things that stood out to me. One, no individual clinical decisions can be addressed, or no clinical decisions regarding an individual can be addressed. And secondly, the approach is not to take, as they say, a legalistic or adversarial approach. In other words, it would appear there's no ability for cross-examination of key decision makers from the time, i.e. Bloomfield and Jacinda Ardern. Now, in conversation with Winston Peters, especially before the election, this was what he wanted. So it looks as if in the coalition negotiations, the New Zealand First attitude to how the second commission of inquiry would be undertaken, New Zealand First have been gazumped by their coalition partners. Do you believe that to be the case?
Well, that's how it looks like on the face of it. So yes, it is extremely disappointing that there's no clinicians on the commission, and that on the face of it, you know, clinical decision making is off the playing field. But, and this is very important, so much of what has happened has been pushed through via policy, and a lot of the clinical stuff has followed on from you know, decisions made, you know, in involving doctors, but plainly around public health policy. So I think there's still an opportunity to get a lot of information across the line. And yes, I think New Zealand First probably do feel disappointed, you know, that they're in a minority in that cabinet, and of course, ACT was a part of the previous parliament. So they, I would say, would have an interest in trying to come out of it, you know, not smelling too badly. But frankly, there is just so much, you know, appalling evidence of harm and let's not say safety, let's say unsafety, that I can't see how they're going to be able to flannel and keep it quiet. You know, there are some very, very, there's very strong evidence that put together and looking at for how long that evidence has been there, you know, to us paints a picture of a sort of systemic suppression. And you could even use the C word, I suppose. And we are, we're certainly asking questions, you know, is there an ongoing cover up now of all of this very powerful, you know, properly conducted peer-reviewed evidence, you know, proving the harms and proving all of the technical and contamination issues that we've been screaming about all the way along the way. You know, new ones keep appearing, and confirmation of the relationship between the rollout and rises in all-cause mortality and which age groups are being affected. You know, it's all consistent. I think it's going to be very hard for this to be shut down. Based on what we've given. So no, it's not perfect by any means. You know, I think they're hoping that the way they've structured it will mean that you know, parliamentary processes and the government won't come out of it too badly. But, you know, we all have our own views about that.
Yeah, but sure. You guys have had 90 minutes with phase one. Are you likely to get any more with phase two? And more importantly, are any other groups with similar attitudes to yours going to be invited to appear at phase two? In other words, is there going to be almost an avalanche of evidence from your side of the fence presented to this inquiry?
Well, I would hope there is. There certainly is an avalanche of evidence that needs to be heard, you know, and the public need to know that not just that there's more than one side to the story, but that, you know, our side is predominantly the most accurate one. So we would want and expect, you know, not just 90 minutes, but several days, ideally, you know, to take the commissioners through and the public.
So how ideally. Do you get that? How do you book such a long submission as that?
Well, I guess that there'd be negotiation and there'll be, you know, an opportunity for people to put their hands up and say they want to be part of it. So, of course, you know, I expect Voices for Freedom will have a lot to say, as will the Health Forum. You know, who've probably done the best job of quantifying and documenting and
Borden,
getting stories. Yeah, and I hope there's many New Zealanders who come along and have the opportunity to tell their story and be heard, you know, to illustrate to the rest of the public actually how bad things have been. So, you know, it's not going to be straightforward, and, you know, we've actually got to get there yet. You know, so we've got this projected date in November when it all kicks off. But I, you know, I have some faith in the, you know, in the fact that there are two barristers there, and particularly there's a criminal barrister. You know, these aren't stupid people, and you know, their whole professional life is around, you know, being in a courtroom and trying to discover the truth of the matter. And you have to hear both sides, and you have to test the truth, and you have to, you know, you have to examine the defense or the mitigating circumstances in this case, you know, that might be there. So it's going to be a fascinating process, but I think there'll be many, many people queuing up to be heard, because, you know, the terms of reference aren't just about safety and effectiveness.
No, that's right. But you talk about, you know, Grant Illingworth being a criminal barrister. You don't really expect any criminal charges to be amongst the recommendations at the end of this report, at the end of this inquiry, when they report in, what is it, February of 2026? You don't expect it to ever go that far, do you? Surely it'll just be maybe severe criticism of government policy, but can you ever see any other outcome apart from just some stern words and maybe a few recommendations, but certainly no action taken against individuals, will there?
I think that's going to have to depend on what the public think, and actually how much the public is able to be informed about what's going on. Because, you know, our view, of course, is that this is, you know, it's almost too bad to describe what's happened. And, you know, it will be very clear, I hope, if this thing is allowed to happen properly and if people are heard correctly and allowed to you know, demonstrate the evidence in support of what they're saying, you know, it's going to take a lot of sort of legal gymnastics and you know, willful blindness and shutting your eyes and your ears to a lot of what's been said, you know, to not want to move to actually as the next stage, which we've always said is important, which is the sort of whole truth and reconciliation approach, where people have to be called to account. You know, they have to have the chance to answer evidence that's put if it shows them in a bad light, and to you know, account for the decision making process, and particularly maybe the you know, because we see increasingly in all the OIOs that are coming out, you know, there's all sorts of contortions going on, and there's just refusing of information that should be released, you know, and if there wasn't anything to hide, and if everything was hunky dory, you know, they wouldn't go through this, but there are consistent patterns of behaviour that that are very suspicious, and I think the public are waking up to. And they're going to want to have a say in what happens next. So it's not just about what the establishment says will happen after the ICI is finished. You know, this has affected all of us. You know, we've all had our lives turned upside down, ended in some cases, you know, wrecked for the rest of their lives. And in the case of disabled people, you know, there's been discrimination, there's been economic chaos, and suffering on all sorts of levels. So if we're really interested in learning from this and what not to do next time, you know, if they're actually interested in this rather than it just being a sort of bit of window dressing for the government, then I think people are going to be very angry with a lot of what they hear, and so they should be.
But what about the presence of Ashley Bloomfield and Jacinda Ardern, Chris James from MedSafe, Ian Town as the government's top scientific advisor? Are these people likely to be anywhere near this inquiry?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so personally.
You can't ask questions of them. They're certainly not going to volunteer their submissions, are they?
Well, we don't know for sure. You know, we don't know that, Peter. But you know, I think you and I would be betting on the same side. Of course, that needs to happen, and there are many people who want to see these people front up, and I really think that when the scale of damage that's been done to the country, and the health system particularly too, really becomes clear, there's going to be an appetite for you know, getting people up and calling them to account, and of course, you know, hearing from them, and there's should always be a presumption that people act, you know, act from their best selves, you know, I think this thing is too big now, and I think the lid's off. And I think, you know, New Zealand First accomplished, you know, a miracle essentially in getting an agreement that there needed to be a phase two. But yes, it's a royal commission, and that comes with its own baggage and its own restrictions and its own sort of, you know, tendencies. You know, it's not going to want to criticize itself, essentially, it's the establishment. But, you know, this whole thing is unprecedented. And I don't think we or any of us ever expected there would be a need to look at a situation like what we've been through in the last 4 years. And we absolutely do not want to have to go through it again. And at the moment, this is the best of what we've got. So I think we should all get stuck in and you know, work it as best we can.
Does phase two have the capability to summons people to appear? I didn't look closely enough at the terms of reference to see whether or not they can. I mean, the Waitangi Tribunal thinks it has that ability, which of course was shot back or shot down recently. But does the Royal Commission, under its Act, under its statutory setup, have the capability to summons witnesses?
Well, I've assumed that the point about it being non-adversarial means that no, it won't. I may well be wrong. You know, and time will tell, and we'll get much more of an idea, I guess, as it becomes sort of formed. And there'll be, you know, there'll be rules sent to people like there was for this one, you know, what you can, you can't say. So we'll just have to wait and see. But right. I would I would really hope, for the sake of the country, that there is as much disclosure, the important people who made the key decisions, you know, and there's a handful of them, and we all know who they are, whose decisions were put in place by many people underneath, of course, but many of those people were well, what's the phrase? I mean, they were just following orders, but it's where those orders came from, and why that we all want to know about.
Well, one of the papers you're going to be putting forward, part of the evidence that NZDSOS is wanting to put forward, concerns a recent piece of research by an organization with a similar name to yours, SOS. I understand they're not to you, but they're the Solution of Scientists International. They have come up with a quite extraordinary piece of research which has been released in recent times about what they've now called the Hirschman clots. Now, there's been a little bit of discussion about this briefly in the mainstream media, briefly on other online radio stations, but then it was dismissed as being way too wacky. This is the business of the clots in the bodies that funeral directors were dealing with. And it seems as if some scientists have done some really good research about this, and they've come up with some quite extraordinary decisions. And Matt, their summary in the press release is just quite frightening, isn't it? It basically says this is a threat for Homo sapiens. And it finished off by saying, God bless humanity. I mean, it's an extraordinary statement they have made, and you're going to put some of this research to the second phase of the inquiry?
Well, we probably will have to, because this story's been out in the public domain for 2 years now, and it's a great illustration, actually, for of what RCI2 is going to have to deal with, and the sort of the personal journey that some of these people will be put through. But the point here is that these white clots, I mean, we first wrote about them 2 years ago. And the evidence has just got stronger and stronger that these things are frequent, and that embalmers are finding these when they're preparing bodies after death. But they've also been found in living patients, and it seems that they're actually forming during life. And it's a sort of mind-bending story if you think about what might be happening in the body. But what's even more mind-bending, from our perspective, is the silence and the ignoring of it that is happening, by at government and scientific institution level. We've been telling people ever since we first heard about it that, look, this needs looking at and it needs some explanation, please. What's going on here? And there's just been the usual silence and giving no oxygen. But a few months ago, we wrote to all of the Australian and New Zealand medical colleges, the surgeons and the radiologists and the GPs and things, saying, look, somebody's got to fess up about what's going on and investigate it, and will you please ask all of your doctor members what they're seeing, because there's been corroboration from enough different directions and perspectives that it is real. And I mean, we've seen these things, and when you hold them and you stretch them and you look at them, there is nothing that's remotely normal about these. And yet, most people don't know about them, and it's a topic that's too hot to touch. So, how is the RCI going to cope? There will be scientific papers, I think, by then. There's this press release, report. So they've worked out what they think is happening with the chemistry, but big deal. That doesn't change the fact that these things have been tangible. They've been occurring in people. They may well be, a cause of death. Amongst the many people that comprise this sort of increase in all-cause mortality. We know that there's strokes and heart attacks and sudden deaths all over the place. It's been real since the first embalmer, Richard Hirschman, said, look, I'm finding these, and in fact, so are other people. And a survey that was done, 70% of the respondent embalmers agreed that they are finding these. I think in around about 20 to 30% of the cases was the consensus. So, this is a common issue. And you know, what do we do with this information? Well, all we can do is to put it out there and ask questions. And you know, on behalf of the public, which largely is kept in the dark at this stage, because, of course, mainstream media won't touch it. But there are independent media organizations and people like yourself, you know, who don't have an agenda, who just want to find out what the truth is, and who don't feel that they have, you know, the power to play God and withhold certain information from people because it's too, you know, it's too bombshell or too hot to handle. And this was a point that we made to the commission, was that, you know, it seems implicit if you're a regulator or a bureaucrat that you just develop this idea that it's perfectly fine to lie to people if it means that you keep them calm and you maintain order. That the first job of a bureaucrat is to ensure public order. Well, you know, that withholding bad news is not something that doctors do. In fact, we get, sadly, you know, a bit of expertise in actually being able to give bad news, because, you know, sometimes for people the news is bad. And it would seem that maybe the news for our species is bad, you know, echoing what they said at the end of their press release. But you will probably put a link to it, I guess, maybe, because I think it should be put around to people, and people should make of it what they will and test it for themselves.
So who are the solution of scientists international? Because they say at the top of this press release, what was the phrase? We remain anonymous for safety reasons. I mean, do you know who they are? Do you know what countries they come from? And why would they say, for safety reasons, we can't say who we are? Because surely that takes away a little bit of the credibility of the report, doesn't it?
Well, they'd probably rather have their credibility taken away than their lives taken away, I guess. Because if you think about the implications of what we're actually saying here, you know, it seems on the face of it that there's something fundamental has been changed about the bodies of people who've taken this product. That's the first sort of, you know, the first gasp kind of implication. And people need to test that and have a look. And we can't find a solution to any of this as long as the problem is still being denied. You know, as soon as it's accepted that, you know, yes, this was, you know, there's some unanticipated stuff that's gone on here, then we can all move very quickly. You can use the best minds and the biggest money to figure out solutions. You know, and they may come quite quickly.
Well, the first solution, surely is to stop the rollout, isn't it? And as of a couple of days ago,
well,
I was hearing radio advertising for COVID injections. Go and get your COVID vaccine.
Of course. That's the start. You have to stop putting more of these things into people. And we've called for this from the beginning. You know, and we've appealed to any sort of political friends we think we might have to, you know, to join that call. But it's obviously just too hard still. And the momentum of government is just plowing on. And I think it's gone on so long that it'd be very difficult for any individuals to acknowledge that maybe they got it wrong. And they're not going to be the first ones to put their hands up and call for a halt. It's just, this is just crowd psychology in play. And the power of the echo chamber, etc. We've spoken about this a lot, but the rest of us, meanwhile, are suffering from that. So yes, it has to be stopped, and there has to be an investigation, even if only to prove that this is wrong. But it's very hard to prove something tangible, like a, you know, long, rubbery, tough white clot, for which there is now you know, a chain of chemistry that would explain what's happening. You know, based on the effect of the you know, the lipid nanoparticles and the spike protein, etc. You know, all the ingredients are in there to explain it. And even if they've got the explanation or bits of the explanation slightly wrong, it does not change the fact that these things are real.
Okay,
and
Matt,
we can't pretend that they're not.
Can I just read from what they call the denouement? It's like an executive summary of this press release. And as you know, it's reasonably long, so bear with me. The sudden appearance of long, white, fibrous clots in the deceased was first observed by embalmers after the COVID vaccines were rolled out. These rubbery clots did not resemble the normal clots, such as red thrombi or chicken fat clots, normally seen in deceased bodies. These clots resemble white thrombi, but unlike normal white thrombi, they are found in veins as well as arteries. The elemental analysis provides evidence of increased phosphorus, sulfur, and tin, each of which contributes to the new clotting phenomenon. The sudden rise in these aberrant white clots, post-COVID vaccines rollout, in subjects undergoing surgery is further evidence of a causal link that needs to be urgently investigated. To date, as of the time of writing, medical professionals and their organizations, including public health bodies, are continuing to deny the existence of these unique, anomalous white thrombi. The fact that there is very strong pressure not to conduct autopsies in those dying suddenly is further evidence of a dangerous cover-up undertaken by health authorities worldwide. Evidence from whistleblowers and brave health professionals who are not afraid to speak up provide a sinister backdrop to what may constitute the greatest public health emergency ever seen. That officials continue to deny the reality of these unique clots can only lead the observer to the conclusion that a vast worldwide cover-up is in force. And then it goes to red lettering. Failure of authorities to act professionally and responsibly in the best interests of public health can only signal a health crisis of unprecedented proportions. If this situation is not addressed in the very near future, there exists a potential for what can only be described as an existential crisis for the species Homo sapiens. May God have mercy upon humanity. I mean, frankly, those are some of the most chilling words I've ever read. Is this SOS group overplaying their hand here, or do you believe that they're on the money?
I think they're probably right about the chemistry of the clots. And I come back to the fact that they are real. They are occurring, and they are occurring frequently, according to the testimony of, you know, professional embalmers who their whole lives have done their jobs. And all of a sudden they're seeing these things that they haven't seen before. So it's new, it's anomalous, and it demands an explanation. And, you know, of as much concern as the fact they're happening is the response of the people who've been told. Now, if they just can't believe it, then they should get out of the way and hand it over to people, you know, who maybe will look at it. But I don't think they've overplayed their hand. We do know who some of them are. There's some New Zealand's and Australian input, but I understand it's actually quite a large collective now of people from all over the world who have key and unique sort of expertise in different elements of chemistry that have all basically been able to, you know, complement each other's knowledge and do the research. And you know, it sort of makes sense to me, but I'm not a chemist. But you know, I don't deny the reality of the fact that is happening, that this is happening. I've seen the clots myself. A friend of mine died from a very rapid cancer, and I spoke to the embalmer who'd done his body, and he was full of these clots. You know, you can see them. You know, you can see photos. You know, that they are real. You can hear people who are saying, we are yanking these out in interventional radiology procedures. You know, we're finding these in living patients, and we're now seeing them frequently enough that you know, it's almost becoming the new normal.
So, Brenton,
we shouldn't let this be normalized. You know, we've got to jump up and down and scream about what it seems like is being done to people.
Matt, Brenton Faithful was a funeral director, embalmer, who was voicing his opinion and his experiences about this, I guess probably last year, maybe the year before, I can't remember. I heard an interview with him on The Platform. He may have even had his name mentioned once or twice in mainstream media articles. But he was quickly dismissed as a nutter, a cooker, because, well, heaven forbid, he wasn't a member of the New Zealand Funeral Directors Association, not part of the funeral body. He was regarded as a bit of a whack job, a bit of an outlier. But are there other people saying the same thing as well? Are you asserting that? And how come Faithful was dismissed so quickly? I mean, if he had evidence, physical evidence, why wasn't he listened to by people who are supposed to be serious investigators?
Well, that's the big question about this whole thing, isn't it? Why haven't the people who are paid to do their jobs you know, come forward and given a fair hearing. Look, when you first hear this and when you first think about it, it's actually, it explodes your brain. It's just very, very hard to encompass. But, you know, we already knew that there were excess deaths. And so something's killing people. And because of the absolute novelty and kind of brand new mechanisms by which this thing is working in people, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise, actually, that there were unintended consequences. What we've got to do quickly is to recognize that that's happening and do something about it. But we've spoken to four New Zealand embalmers. In fact, we wrote it up and posted it a month or two ago, who are all saying the same thing. And there are many internationally, and there's been a lot of work done in the States. And although the associations themselves are saying officially there's nothing to see here, you know, when you talk to individuals, they tell the truth. So Brenton is credible, and he tells the same story that other people tell. And of course he's going to be dismissed by mainstream media and by the establishment, because it's made its business to dismiss anything that might you know, furrow our brows and get us worried. That's just what it does. You know, it's made up of human beings, you know, with all their frailties, but those frailties are magnified when they're in groups and echo chambers and you know, vested interests and things. So we have to take charge of this ourselves, and we have to somehow get their attention and demand that this thing stops while they investigate. But there's been any number of shoes that have dropped in the last couple of years, any one of which ought to have given MedSafe pause and to withdraw the thing while they investigated. But they've ignored every one of those. You know, we've been telling them, and there's no difference with this issue either. You know, we haven't heard a word from any of them. Not even, you know, you guys are crazy. This is all you're seeing. I mean, no, there's been nothing, because I don't think they've got anything. There's no credible kind of way of dismissing, you know, the reality of these things. You know, it's not arguing about data and interpreting numbers and things. This is real, tangible changes in human blood.
So who's going to tell the Royal Commission of Inquiry Phase 2 about this? Will there be more than one organization? Will you guys be submitting on it? Will this Solution of Scientists International be submitting? Will the New Zealand Funeral Directors Association or individual funeral directors be submitting on it? Because it's extraordinary evidence that the chemical makeup of the clots that have been discovered, that has been discovered by these scientists, is extraordinary. As I mentioned in that long executive summary, when you put in words like phosphorus, sulfur, and tin, high quantities of tin being found in the blood of deceased people, you wonder what the heck's going on here.
Well, and so we should all wonder what the heck's going on. I mean, something's going on, and there were always going to be elements showing up when you do analysis. You know, and these guys have done quite a lot of testing. They've managed to get it done. It's taken a while, I understand, because of the difficulties of finding labs, you know, who'll agree to do the work. But, you know, something that sticks out like a sore thumb, like tin, you know, which is not in any way an essential nutrient, but we're all exposed to it through just, you know, PVC water pipes and foods and things like that. You know, it turns out that it is a powerful ingredient in the formation of proteins, these sort of protein polymer structures. Tin really encourages what's called cross-linking. So, you know, the body, it seems what's happening is that the body is being triggered to start a clot, but that process is being directed in a wrong direction by the presence of these things from outside the body, components of the injection and, you know, a bit of tin knocking around and you know, who knows what other things. But there's a consistency in the elements that turn up as different groups have looked at what's going on. And there's been a lot of reporting and a lot of people who've been scratching their heads and coming up with explanations that are all converging on what these SOS guys, I think, have shown very elegantly. You know, for a year or two. And as you say, Brenton was first speaking out in 2002. So it's not like this is a sudden bombshell. It's that people have been trying to get the attention, well, of the public too, as well as the establishment scientists, and all we can do is keep speaking out and tell the story to the public, because in the end, if the government people aren't going to do anything, then somebody else is going to have to, if we decide as a collective that we want this to stop.
Matt, New Zealand Doctors Speaking Up with Science held a very successful one-day conference in Auckland last September. Star appearance was Asim Malhotra, the cardiologist from Britain, who changed his mind on the impact of the COVID-19 vaccine after he himself was vaccinated, but after his father passed away. He travelled the world. He spoke about the dangers, what he perceived as the dangers of the vaccine. Asim Malhotra was an outstanding presenter, not just in Auckland at that conference, but he also spoke, I understand, at other places around the country to enthusiastic audiences. After the success of last year, NZDSOS is holding not one but two conferences this year, one in Auckland and one in Christchurch. And you've got, once again, a good lineup, a great lineup of speakers, including a man that we heard plenty about during the early days of the COVID response, Dr. Paul Marrick, one of the co-founders with Pierre Corey of the FLCCC, the Frontline COVID Critical Care Group. So tell us about Paul Marrick, how you managed to get him, what he's likely to talk about, and when these conferences are on. Are they consecutive Saturdays coming up later this month in September?
Yeah, sure. Of course, we haven't just got Paul, as you say. We've got a whole bunch of people. Yes, 21st of September in Christchurch, and then the following Saturday, the 28th of September in Auckland. We were asked last year after our very successful conference to do something in South Island. So we're really, we're really keen to, see people, come along and just experience just the joy and the relief and all the other things that happen of being in, a room with a large number of other people who are all on the same page, because so many of us have felt isolated, and it was actually a really great therapy, I think, for a lot of people, certainly last year. And we're really wanting to repeat that this year. So Kiwis are famously sort of last minute bookers, I think. But we, we'd love it. Would really help us if people who are going to come could just, jump online and get their tickets. We're really only interested in covering our costs. So we've kept the ticket prices as cheap as we possibly can. But we've got good venues and we've got a whole bunch of really exciting and interesting speakers, I think. So you asked about Paul. We haven't sort of seen their presentations yet, but our theme is about the way forward and positivity and helping people, make changes. The story that we've just spoken about, the white clot things, I guess, is a good example of what is required of people who maybe are on the fence or haven't yet kind of understood what's gone on, what they're going to have to get their heads around. So we're actually very excited to have David Charalambos, who's a professional in the area of the sort of the psychological forces that play on people's decision making and their behaviour. And he's a very good teacher, so he'll be offering practical insights, into how to communicate more effectively and things. And we have got Paul, who's an intensive care specialist. And he was one of the first people at the beginning of COVID to be publishing protocols and saying, look, this is what we're seeing is working in these, unusually ill people with this, novel disease that doesn't seem to be just, a sort of straightforward viral pneumonia as we would understand it. There's other stuff going on. He and Peter McCullough and a few others were getting stuck in and actually figuring out what worked. But he's an intensive care specialist, so he's got academic credibility. He's published a lot, and we've got some other people as well. Alison and I will be speaking. We've got Manny Garcia who'll be speaking in Christchurch, and then we're actually very pleased to have as our MC actually Graham Hood, who is a Qantas pilot, and he spoke out at the beginning about illness and jab side effects amongst pilots, but also the apparent attempts to kind of you know, just be okay with this and hide some of what was going on by the Australian, well, I guess it's the Civil Aviation Authority, whatever their equivalent is. But he's an engaging and dynamic speaker. You know, he's very well informed and very funny. And he you know, he travels relentlessly around Australia, you know, doing talks and trying to get the word out and waking people up. And I think, you know, we're very lucky to have him. We've got Angus Dalgleish, who's a very distinguished oncologist, probably one of the best known in the UK, who's been, you know, talking about the changes that he's seen. You know, he's seeing a lot more cancer patients, and he's seeing people who whose cancers went away recur. He's seeing, you know, cancers in younger people, all the things that other people are saying as well, and that we're hearing on the ground. So I'm not sure what he'll be talking about, but you know, there's certainly you know, data proving that there is a lot more cancer. However, in New Zealand, they're doggedly refusing to give any up-to-date statistics. I think 2020 is the last year. They've certainly been refusing OIAs. So, you know, they'll have to join the queue of refused OIA requests that go to the ombudsman, who often either doesn't get anywhere himself or just says, well, no, it's, you know, it's not in the public interest to have this information. But he's, you know, he's pointed out there are data sets that prove there's rising cancer rates, and especially in young people. And then we've got Katie Ashby-Coppins, who you will know well, a very seasoned lawyer who's doing some great work in Australia. That's where she's based. But she's coming, and she'll be speaking to us about some of the very hopeful cases, actually, that are happening. And again, you won't hear about this on the 6 o'clock news, but there's been some quite successful challenges, particularly in the Queensland courts, on sort of human rights grounds that are, you know, and they're all building on each other. You know, you need a sort of a string of wins in the legal system, then the momentum changes, and judges tend to hunt in packs, and but you need somebody to kind of break ranks first and do an important judgment, and then other things can happen. And we think we're seeing signs of that, certainly in Australia, and it'd be nice to see that here as well. So that's our speakers. So it's the same set of speakers in Christchurch and Auckland. But we, you know, we really would love to see people in Christchurch.
And is everybody going to be there in person, Matt? No video lens?
Yep. No, so, no, we're all in person.
Paul Marek, South African born, now American domiciled, is coming from the States, and Angus Dalgleish coming from the UK. So that's great. Two highly respected and qualified international medical practitioners, specialist medical practitioners coming to speak.
Yeah, we're very excited and very, very proud to be able to host them, actually. And they, you know, they were very keen to come because, you know, we make quite a noise, I think, on an international sort of level. You know, so they see what's happening in New Zealand, and what we're trying to do in NZDSOS, I think, is a sort of, you know, a very important plank in the kind of the worldwide move for truth and disclosure, and to begin some sort of healing process. And to rescue ourselves from you know, a number of different barrels of the gun that we feel that we're staring down.
Very great, Matt. Fantastic. We look forward to those two dates, September the 21st in Christchurch and September the 28th in Auckland. I can vouch from personal experience, having been to the one in Auckland last year, a memorable day, absolutely memorable, thoroughly enjoyable and engaging day. And I can't recommend this conference highly enough if it's going to be as good as last year. So details, nzdsos-conference.com, all the details, and you can register. Matt, thank you so much for talking with us today here on RCR. Well done on your first submission. We look forward to your second commission to the Royal Commission of Inquiry into COVID-19. As somebody once said, you are doing God's work, so keep at it.
Well, all we can do is do what we can. And as long as we do that, we're sort of covered, I guess. But thanks for having me on, Peter.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.